Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has held some very interesting positions in the Russian government at critical moments in the evolution of his country from a Soviet system to a transition to democracy to, well, a transition to autocracy, one might say, if not worse. His name is Andrei Ilarionov. He is a Russian economist by training. He has served as the economic advisor to several leaders of Russia, including, for a time, the acting prime minister, Yegor Gaidar. He has also served as a chief economic advisor to Russia's prime minister, Viktor Chernomyrdin, and, not least, a chief economic advisor to Russia's president, Vladimir Putin. There is considerable interest at the moment in Mr. Putin, what he is thinking, what he intends to do, specifically with respect to Ukraine. And Andrei, who I'm thrilled to say is these days a fellow of our Center for Security Policy, has written an important piece entitled, "There Won't Be a Big War Anytime Soon." This is a very interesting insight, I know, born of experience with Putin, and it's a privilege to have a chance to talk with Andrei about that proposition and other aspects of the challenge we're facing from the Putin regime in Russia at length for this full hour. Andrei Ilarionov, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio once again. It's great to have you back, and thank you for giving us generously of your time.
Thank you, Frank, for inviting me to this radio and for inviting to speak on the current situation in Russia, in Ukraine, and in the United States. This is not the least.
You bring to bear some important insights in all of these respects. We've caught up with you, as I understand it, in Kyiv, as it's now being pronounced, the capital of Ukraine. It is a nation that is seemingly surrounded by increasing numbers of Russian forces, some of them shipped all the way from eastern Russia for the purpose of threatening, it would appear, both Ukraine and perhaps, if not violently, certainly geostrategically, NATO. I'm very curious as to what you make of Putin's behavior and why it is that you think that there will not be a conflict arising from this deployment of large numbers of military personnel.
Right. Let me start from the very widely announced attack on Ukraine on February 16, as we were heard that President Biden has informed his colleagues, so-called transatlantic leaders, in his telephone conversation or video conference on February 11th. When President Biden has informed leaders of the Western countries that, according to the U.S. intelligence, Putin is going to attack Ukraine on February 16th. And then we have heard Mr. Sullivan, security assistant, national security assistant, to President Biden, who has provided so-called detailed description how Russian troops will attack Ukraine with air bombardment, with missiles attacks, with ground forces crossing Belarusian-Ukrainian border. We've heard that Kyiv can be taken within 2 days. We've read that it's going to be 50,000 people killed in this attack, and many hundred thousands will be wounded, and 5 million people will become refugees. We've heard all this and we've read it over the last couple of weeks. I'm right now in Kyiv. Kyiv absolutely calm. Kyiv is peaceful. There is no attack, neither crossing of the border, neither direct Russian-Ukrainian border, nor line of contact in Donbas, no attack from Crimea, no attack from the Belarusian territory. There is no air bombardment. There is no missiles attacks. There is no losses. There is no wounded. There is no refugees for the moment. So Mr. Putin did not attack. It was exactly what has been predicted by myself and by Mike Waller and myself in the piece that you have mentioned, that we have written and published. We are following the events in Ukraine, in Russia, along the Russian-Ukrainian border. And since November 12th, I just would like to mention, I keep saying there will be no big war from the Russian side against Ukraine. And there are many reasons for that. I don't know whether we have time right now to mention some of them. Okay.
No, I very much want to drill down on those because, Andrei, obviously what we're being told by the Biden administration is very different from that. As you say, they were wrong about the 16th, as it happens. They may be wrong about the whole thing. But I will tell you my own view of this is that Putin certainly would be unlikely to move against Ukraine prior to the end of the Olympic Games. I think by prearrangement with the Chinese, be my guess, so as not to rain on Xi Jinping's parade, if you will. But your thesis that despite the massing of forces, despite the seeming continuing buildup, despite claims that some of those forces are now being removed, there is no prospect of them actually going into Ukraine in force. And I very much appreciate your elaborating why you feel that so.
All right. Let me mention at least some positions, and if we have time, we can elaborate on each of them. First of all, U.S. intelligence had made many mistakes in the past, and there is no confirmation of all these reports associated with the so-called U.S. intelligence concerning the preparation for the attack against Ukraine. We know that it was mistakes with on the part of U.S. intelligence regarding 9/11. On presence of weapons of mass destruction in Saddam's Iraq, on failure to predict the rapid collapse of Kabul government last summer. U.S. intelligence was not able to see, on the other hand, the preparation of Russian attack on Georgia in August year 2008, on occupation of Crimea in February, March year 2014, attack on Ukrainian troops in August year 2014 near Ilovaisk and in February year 2015 near Debaltseve. I can continue, but it's enough to see that something wrong with U.S. intelligence, and probably this is an area that should be really seriously fixed because it's a problem for the United States and this problem for the West and for the free world. If the intelligence does not provide objective and timely information about the preparations and attacks of rogue governments, of authoritarian regimes, and that's a really serious problem for the free world.
I don't disagree. There's a problem in this case, it seems to me, Andrea. On the one hand, assessing adequately and competently the capabilities that now are in place, and then trying to draw some conclusions about the intentions of the person who has brought them to bear, a man you know well, Vladimir Putin. U.S. intelligence has not always gotten it right, as you say, particularly of late, on even the capability side, let alone the intentions. But as you look at it in this case, is it of no consequence that the capabilities for an invasion have been put into place by Putin? And now, encircling really the entirety of Ukraine, not just the eastern reaches.
Yes and no. So Russian troops right now are located on three sides of Ukraine, on east, on south, and on north, but not in the west. Western borders of Ukraine with Poland, with Slovakia, with Hungary, with Romania are not under attack. All of these countries are NATO members, and they are absolutely secure and calm, and there is no problem and no threat for Ukraine from that side. But the most important point concerning, because there is a long list of explanation why Mr. Putin is not able to and is not going to attack. That is even more important, because Mr. Putin does not have neither capability nor intent of attack on Ukraine. But let me talk first of all about the capability. We've heard and we read regularly over the last 3.5 months that Mr. Putin has amassed about 100,000 troops on the Russian-Ukrainian border. Over the last couple of weeks, this number has been raised up. And the latest information about the total amount of Russian troops is 148,000. This is a data from the Ukrainian military intelligence. This is latest information that became available a couple of days ago. 148,000 Russian troops. We need to ask ourselves how much troops Ukraine does have at this moment. And we have this number. The size of Ukrainian military is 261,000. Ukrainian president issued decree to increase army by another 100,000 troops. Ukraine has in active reserve 200,000 troops. Ukraine has 400,000 veterans who did participate in the war in Donbas and are ready to take arms right away. Ukraine introduced territorial defense formations, and people are actively joining those territorial defense. Secretary of Council, Ukrainian Council for Defense and Security, Mr. Danilov, has informed that in all formations of Ukraine, there are about 2 million people who are either having their arms and or are ready to take arms immediately to defend the country. Regardless of what kind of number we would take, either the last one, 2 million, or even the very best one, or the very first one, 261,000 in Ukrainian military, each of these numbers is much larger than 148,000 on the Russian side. So we can ask ourselves whether that amount of troops on the Russian side is enough to carry attack against Ukraine. And the answer will be either from the historical experience on the Ukrainian territory in previous conflicts, like in the Second World War, or in the modern warfare that has been conducted either by Russia or, let's say, by other countries like the United States or by Israel or by Arab countries or by Iran or by any other country or China recently. And we will find that for attacking and trying to conquer and occupy such country like Ukraine or substantial portion of such country like Ukraine, it is necessary to have much larger troop formations. We've done calculations based on the experience of Russian general staff, how much troops Russian general staff was using in the attack against other countries. And based on this factual experience of the Russian troops and previously Soviet troops, they came to the conclusion that to attack left bank Ukraine, it's the eastern part of Ukraine, east of Dnieper River, Russia would need 1 million troops. If Putin would like to occupy not only left bank Ukraine, but also southern Ukraine, he would need 1.5 million troops. When Putin attacked Georgia in August year 2008, he used against 27,000 of Georgian troops, 83,000 of Russian troops, which means three times more. Just to be sure that Georgian troops, Ukrainian troops, is of quality not less than Georgian troops, are much higher, and it is after 8 years of very serious war with Russians. So that is why to attack Ukraine, Putin would need definitely more Russian troops than the number of Ukrainian troops. Whether it will be three times larger or another level, but it would be larger.
If this is a very interesting and quantitative analysis that you've provided, I guess what one would expect from a serious economist. There's a qualitative aspect to this that I wonder if that factors into your consideration. And admittedly, quantity has a quality all its own, as I think Stalin put it. So the size of Ukrainian forces that could be brought to bear is substantially in excess to what Russia has on the frontier at the moment. I think you're absolutely right about that. The question, I guess, is given the superior, weaponry, firepower, power projection capabilities, air power, and the like that Russia could presumably bring into the mix. Does that change at all the calculus here, or is it still, at the end of the day, your conviction that Vladimir Putin has no intention to use any of that stuff in Ukraine, and that this is all designed for other purposes that I want to draw you out on in a moment.
Even before we can discuss quality, quantity, we need to at least to drop a look on the quality of troops, of military. And fortunately, we have a reasonable indicator of quality of Ukrainian troops vis-a-vis Russian troops. Over the last 8 years, we have data for losses on both sides, and actually on the Russian side and the so-called Russian separatist side, were active participation of the regular Russian troops in year 2014, in year 2015, and through the all 8 years, all formations of separatists are led by Russian officers just on the regular service. So we have these numbers. For each 100 people being killed on the Ukrainian side, it is 138 military being killed on the Russian side. So which means in this long conventional type warfare, the quality of troops on both sides definitely approximately the same, but it looks like the quality of Ukrainian troops is slightly higher than the Russian troops. So that is why we cannot expect Russian troops an easy work as they had in Crimea in year 2014 when Ukrainian army did not offer any resistance and just evacuated from the peninsula. It will be hard, bloody, long, heavy battle on all fronts, as it was during the last 8 years on the Eastern Front. So that is why it's clear that Russians could not expect have less troops than number of Ukrainian troops on this front. So that is why they would need at least the same number of Russian troops on the front. But as we know from the Russian-Georgian war of year 2008, Putin put three times more troops than the total number of Georgian troops. based on the previous experience, we should expect something similar. The numerical superiority of the Russian troops, assuming the quality of Ukrainian troops right now. So that is why we would expect that the number of troops that Putin must amass on the Russian-Ukrainian border should be not less than 700,000 or 800,000 to start, even think about some serious operation against Ukraine. Definitely. Now, Putin does not have this amount.
Yeah, and that's even when you factor in the qualitative edge that that he has. So let me just ask a couple of questions that are sort of to your larger point, which is, so what is Putin up to? What does he seek out of all of this? It may not be sufficient numbers of forces to do the job if he has in mind invading any part of Ukraine, let alone, you know, the entirety of it. But it was clearly for some purpose that he went to these lengths. And I wonder what your current reading is on that purpose and if it's being satisfied.
Putin has in his mind two goals. One is his personal goal. He is trying to convince or to force, to be correctly, Ukrainian government and Ukrainian president, Mr. Zelensky, to start to fulfill the so-called Minsk agreement, which essentially destroys Ukrainian sovereignty by providing enormous power and resources and status and legal positions for the separatists in the east of Donbas, and which essentially would take control over domestic and foreign policy in Kyiv itself. That's one goal of Mr. Putin. But the second goal, probably not less important than Minsk, is his help to Mr. Biden. Because this campaign that we became witnesses over the last 3.5 months, it is first of all not Mr. Putin's campaign, it is Mr. Biden's campaign.
And by that you mean what's been described as a wag the dog exercise to deflect attention from his various serious domestic political challenges at the moment, Joe Biden's?
Absolutely, yes. First of all, we need to remember that the whole campaign, this propaganda campaign, has been launched by American media associated with the Biden's administration. It has been launched by Washington Post on October 30th, 2021. Continued with Politica, Bloomberg, CNN, Foreign Policy, and so on. That's this campaign. We need to remember when this campaign has been launched and why Mr. Biden so-called proclaimed that the attack on Ukraine should happen on February 16th. You know why? It is my hypothesis. But it is very suspicious coincidence that on February 16th or around that day, Prosecutor Durham has made public new information about the Democratic Party that was spying against Trump when he was in the White House. And instead of discussing these unbelievable situation that is just probably does not have comparison in the US history, the American media as well as the world media is discussing something that was not going to happen and did not happen, the so-called attack on Ukraine.
This is a proposition that obviously has adherence, and there are people who are deeply skeptical of it. I must say that I'm somewhat in the middle on having a belief that Putin would have his own compelling reasons, and you've mentioned several. Another that I would probably add is a desire to fracture NATO, to demonstrate that it is a empty shell rather than a serious force against Russia, and perhaps make inroads with the Germans' help in, you know, further asserting Russian influence and perhaps even dominance in Europe through the energy weapon, if nothing else. I must say, and you've obviously spent a lot more time with him than I have, Andrei Ilyarinov, the sense that I have had from Putin over quite some time is that he has very little regard for Joe Biden. In fact, I think he's been rather overt in his contempt for him in the past, and that helping this president is not uppermost in his mind. Am I misreading his attitude towards Biden specifically and towards the United States more generally at the moment?
It looks like Mr. Putin found Mr. Biden as extremely useful person in the position of the U.S. president, because nobody among U.S. president was so helpful and so useful for Mr. Putin in his own business. Mr. Biden has announced that Ukraine would not join NATO anytime soon. Mr. Biden has broken the diplomatic blockade in which Putin was for a number of years since attack on Ukraine in year 2014. Mr. Putin has been invited by Mr. Biden to Geneva to their summit. And since then, all Western leaders from France, from Germany, from other countries are visiting Mr. Putin regularly. That was not the case in the previous 8 years. So that is why Putin found Mr. Biden extremely useful. And he found Mr. Biden is extremely useful in destroying NATO, as you have mentioned earlier. So that is why it is not business of and not so much business of Mr. Putin himself. He can rely on Mr. Biden in destruction of NATO. And right now we see that this campaign on the so-called attack against Ukraine has been launched in the late October year 2021, when exactly Mr. Durham, Prosecutor Durham, has started to publish first information about the Mr. Danchenko and some other operative of Clinton campaign that were involved in illegal or definitely very suspicious behavior against the competitor in year 2016. So, and once again, instead of discussing this very painful story for Mr. Biden and for Democratic Party in the U.S. media, the attention of U.S. media as well as world media has been distracted and diverted to something that does not exist. I mean, this intention of Mr. Putin to attack Ukraine. And we have not seen any intention of Mr. Putin to attack Ukraine since a very serious debacle of Mr. Putin near Debaltseve in February year 2015, 7 years ago. Since then, Putin did not start any serious operation against Ukraine.
The theory of the case, then, if I understand it correctly, is that Vladimir Putin regards Joe Biden as a useful figure in the presidency of the United States, helpful to his purposes, that this theatrical exercise has been perhaps designed to intimidate Ukraine, perhaps designed to show the weakness and otherwise lift up Putin's efforts to sort of reestablish the sphere of influence in at least Eastern Europe, if not more broadly. But that at the end of the day, it was never meant to be a serious threat to Ukraine. And I guess the question that I have is, having seen how this has all played out, is there a possibility that Putin may decide, as the Duma in Russia is encouraging him to do, to recognize the independence of the states that make up Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk, and set in train a process of dismembering over time Ukraine, having already started that process, of course, with Crimea in the past, that may be simply exploiting the weakness of the United States and without investing the forces and engaging in the war that you think he does not want to have, for, I think, some pretty sensible reasons, as you've put it. He nonetheless can garner some considerable benefit from Biden's, weakness, for want of a better term.
First of all, I need to say that definitely Putin does produce a threat to Ukraine, since he's waging war against Ukraine for 8 years. It is incorrect to say that there is no war. War has been launched 8 years ago, and it is continues. The discussion that we're having right now, whether Putin is going to have a big war, a new large-scale operation with the purpose of occupation of all Ukraine or a substantial portion of Ukraine, like Left Bank Ukraine with or Southern Ukraine or Kyiv and something like that. That war is no doubt war continuous, and there will be a lot of skirmishes. It could be a lot of provocations, exchanges of shootings, no doubt. But the large-scale operation with the goal of conquering substantial portions of Ukraine, that looks unrealistic. As for, and we knew that Putin launched cyber attacks against Ukraine. He is having military maneuvers, naval maneuvers in the Black Sea that is almost blocking Ukrainian seaports. That is continuation of the traditional operation on Putin's side against Ukraine. And no doubt that Putin will continue such operations against Ukraine. But what I'm talking about the large-scale attack with missiles, with air bombardment, with the land incursion and so on, that's no basis so far. As for the so-called State Duma call to Putin to recognize DNR LNR, so-called republics in East Donbass, that's a diplomatic game. Game that Putin needs another argument to try to put a pressure on the Ukrainian government, on European governments. He's trying to blackmail Kyiv as well as the European capitals with a potential recognition of the so-called separatist republics in order to get Ukraine to implement Minsk agreement. But Putin does not have intention to recognize independence of these republics, because as soon as he recognizes the independence of those republics or annexation of those republics, he would lose all arguments that he cherished so much, the mainly Minsk agreement. Immediately after that, he would lose this, the most important card in his game.
What replaces the Minsk agreement, in your judgment, Andrei?
I think the best way for the Ukrainian part, as well as for the Western side, I mean, for real allies of Ukraine, is just to try to find solution on the international law, on the basis of international law. And international law is unequivocal about this. It's a restoration of internationally recognized Ukrainian-Russian border or Russian-Ukrainian border as it was in January 2014, with Eastern Donbass, Crimea, and Sevastopol inalienable parts of Ukraine. And that exactly that all body of international law stipulates unequivocally. This is a charter of the United Nations. This is a act of security conference in Helsinki in 1975. This is the Budapest Memorandum. This is the agreement on formation of CIS. This is a bilateral Russian-Ukrainian treaty, which is still valid. and it is not denounced even by the Russian side. There is no peace in international law that recognizes annexation of Crimea and Sevastopol, and there is all body of international law stipulates that the Russian-Ukrainian border includes Donbas, Sevastopol, and Crimea as indelible parts of Ukraine. So that's the best way is to follow international law.
This would not seem to be terribly appetizing to your old boss, Vladimir Putin. Andrei, am I missing something?
Yes, but okay. Mr. Saddam Hussein did not like international law when he occupied and annexed Kuwait. But sometime later, he was forced to recognize that Kuwait is Kuwait. It is an independent country. Eastern Timor has been occupied by Indonesia and has been kept for 23 years. But after that, Indonesia evacuated its troops from Eastern Timor, and Eastern Timor has been proclaimed as independent state. Okay, that's a lot of stories in history, including Alsace and Lorraine, that have been occupied by Germany twice. But after that, after some time, both of those provinces have been returned to France. So we can continue with these examples. Since 1945, UN Charter proclaimed inviolability of internationally recognized borders, that is a leading principle in international law. It's not always it's possible to implement this principle overnight, but sooner or later, it will be the main basis for solving all problems. So that is why, if not Putin himself, but any other Russian leader who would become occupier of Kremlin after Putin, would recognize international law, would evacuate Russian troops from Donbas, Crimea, and Sevastopol, and international law and international recognized Russian-Ukrainian border will be restored.
You have, I think it's fair to say, rather significantly broken with Putin over the years. In fact, you've been a very forceful critic of his, it seems, and I commend you for that. I wanted to just ask you this sort of threshold question as you see it, Andrei. There are those in this country who believe that we don't have an interest in Ukraine, that it shouldn't be of any particular concern to us whether Putin has his way with the place or doesn't, that we certainly shouldn't be involved in trying to discourage him from whatever he might have in mind there in the way of territorial or other ambitions. And that in particular, Ukraine is undeserving of our support because it is an authoritarian government, not a democratic one, and at that it is corrupt and seriously wanting in a number of respects. You're there now, and so I guess I'm asking you to speak as candidly as you feel you can, but what are your thoughts about that assessment of our interests or lack thereof?
I would dispute the statements that claiming that Ukraine is authoritarian regime. There is no international organization or any think tank that is measuring the level of democracy or level of civil liberties on political rights that would claim Ukraine as authoritarian regime. There is not a single one. Ukraine is not perfect democracy. It's not like Sweden or Switzerland. Yes, it's true, but it is a reasonably successful democratic government with six presidents holding the positions of the number one person in the country since its independence. Unlike, for example, Russia, where there were only three persons, and Mr. Putin is occupying this position for more than two decades. Or neighboring Belarus, where Lukashenko is occupying this position for 28 years. So that's no anything common between Ukraine and Russia and Belarus on the other side. As for Ukraine, yes. As for corruption, yes, there is a corruption in Ukraine, but it is not more than in Russia. And actually, Ukraine is less corrupted than number of NATO members that are members of this alliance for a number of years. And when President Biden last June has mentioned a level of corruption in Ukraine as a factor that does not allow Ukraine to become a member of NATO, there are a number of acting NATO member countries that are more corrupted, according to the international think tanks and ratings of measuring corruption. So corruption is such stuff that we can find in many other countries, even in the Western countries, even in very developed countries. Yes, Ukraine is making steps in fighting the corruption. Today's level of corruption is lower than it was a number of years ago. So, and it's a process, and as in many other countries. So it is but Ukraine has something that not very many countries do have: very thriving civil society. Civil society that the best check and balance for political regime, when some political leaders of Ukraine are having authoritarian intentions. That's true. Some of Ukrainian leaders did have such authoritarian intentions. Ukrainian civil society strongly disagreed, as it was during Maidan in year 2004 and during Maidan year 2013-14. And Ukrainian civil society did correct their authoritarian leaders. So that is why Ukraine is much freer than many of the of its neighbors, and it's making steps in right direction. It makes right intention to join Euro-Atlantic community, to be respected and respectable democratic society and democratic political regime.
You almost certainly are right that there are few analysis. Analyses of this country of Ukraine in the think tank world and so on that would reach this conclusion that I described, that Ukraine is an authoritarian, non-democratic, and thoroughly corrupt place. But it is something that is being touted with regularity by a man I generally respect, Tucker Carlson, and guests on his program, and it's one of those things. I wonder whether it just by being repeated often enough takes on a life of its own. But let me ask you about one other aspect of this, if I may, Andre, and that is it's not generally been mentioned in the context of the present crisis and America's interest in it. But back in 1994, we did enter into a solemn treaty undertaking with Russia, as well as Ukraine and some other countries, to guarantee the security of Ukraine if it relinquished the some 200 nuclear weapons that had been bequested in a fashion to it after the Soviet Union collapsed. Do we, in fact, as you see it, have an obligation to the security of Ukraine as a result?
Based on the Budapest Memorandum, this is international law, it's very clear. The three or four, actually, great powers, United States, Britain, France, Russia, have provided security assurances to Ukraine, to territorial integrity, meaning the current border of Ukraine. So that is why this is a written document and signed document by all these countries. So that is why there is some obligations on part of all countries. United States did not violate this memorandum. It was Russia who violated that memorandum. But United States, as well as other Western countries, have a genuine interest in keeping freedom, independence, and territorial sovereignty of Ukraine. And the reason is very clear. It is in history. As we well know, in 1938, Western countries did think that giving up to Germany at the expense of Czechoslovakia with Sudeten land would save peace in Europe. We know what happened in Munich in 1938, and it was the pathway to the Second World War. And that's very painful lesson for today and for any future. It's much easier and less expensive to stop aggressor right at the beginning, because if aggressor will not be stopped, as aggressor was not stopped in Georgia in year 2008, in Ukraine in year 2014, appetite of aggressor is rising, and the price to pay for calming down aggressor is much higher. So that is why this is a genuine interest of all free world that aggressor would not make a one step further. And that is why to defend Ukraine and to provide Ukraine with all necessary help that the aggressor would not have any chance for any new attacks and incursions. And the sooner the international law and Russian-Ukrainian border and Russian-Georgian border will be restored, this is better for the world peace.
I very strongly agree with that, and I think you said it exceedingly well. I really appreciate your insights into this, especially informed as they are, Andrei Ilarionov, about the thinking of a man with whom you had worked for some time, Vladimir Putin. Lastly, and let me just ask you to sort of lay out how this all ties together, if you see that it does. Very recently, Vladimir Putin met with Xi Jinping of China and announced what I think of as a new axis between the two countries. There is much evidence both in what was said in that joint statement that they issued and in their behavior in, among other things, military exercises in the years running up to it, that this is a strategic partnership that has an aggressive quality to it. And perhaps, as you say, in this case, that will not be given expression with an invasion of Ukraine. I'd be interested in your thoughts as to whether it may give expression in the not-too-distant future to an invasion of Taiwan. But one of the things that seems to me very likely, Andrei, is that Russia will have China's back and China will have Russia's back in whatever either of them do. And perhaps more broadly, a kind of axis that has developed with Iran and North Korea and perhaps Pakistan and who knows others, maybe in Latin America, coming into play as well should things go very badly. For example, in Taiwan. How do you see that strategic relationship and its implications again for, if not in Ukraine, as you say, perhaps elsewhere, conflict breaking out on possibly a massive scale?
No doubt, this strategic alliance between China and Russia poses a really very serious threat to the free world. No doubt. At this moment, seems to me, this is process. The process of formation of this alliance is at early stages. And from my point of view, it is important for the Western countries to undertake measures and steps that would prevent this alliance in evolving in the full-scale political, diplomatic and military alliance. It is not yet there. And there are some suspicions on each side, on Chinese side towards Russia, on Russian side towards China. And there is no full trust between them. And that is why it is critically important for the Western countries, for smart Western diplomacy to prevent this alliance to evolve in something that we have seen as you mentioned earlier, on excess that we have seen in the 1930s and the 1940s, and another axis that produced so much destruction to the world because of formation of this alliance of authoritarian, totalitarian regimes and aggressors. And the incoming days and weeks and months will show whether Western leaders really learned lessons of the years leading to the Second World War, and whether they are able not to repeat those mistakes and to prevent formation of this alliance in another really full-scale war.
We have to leave it at that. Dr. Andrei Ilarionov, it has been a distinct honor to speak with you and to hear you addressing so forthrightly both the challenges of the moment, but also more broadly, what we must do to secure ourselves and the free world. And I'm very moved by your using that term, because it seems to be something that is less and less identified as a vital interest of the United States to both lead and preserve in the face of a lot of threats to it, freedom and the nations that make up the free world. I so appreciate your work with us at the Center for Security Policy, and look forward to many more conversations. But this one will be very special, I think, because of both its content and its timeliness. And we look forward, as I say, to continue it with you in the near future. In the meantime, stay well. Godspeed in Ukraine. And I hope that your prognoses about its future fate, especially in the immediate future, prove to be exactly right. God bless you, sir.
Thank you. We'll talk soon. Thank you very much, Frank. Thanks.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.